Well, thank you very much indeed, Colin, and it is really genuinely a great pleasure to be here today. And it's a real honour, in fact, and when I was looking back at some of the previous speakers you've had at these events, I have to say the adrenaline level went up a little bit, and having seen the names of people like Sir David King and Lord Krebs, I have to say I really feel like I'm walking in the footsteps of giants. But I'll do my best. When I spoke with Colin about this talk, it kind of quickly became apparent to me that he perhaps wasn't most interested in some of the day-to-day work that I do at the MRC in Cambridge. But so this talk has perhaps got fewer confidence intervals and p-values than some of you might be used to me presenting. But that's probably reasonable for this time of day. And instead, what I want to do is to, take my starting point from the whole issue of responsibility and think about what we mean by the phrase responsibility when it comes to matters of food and public health. So let me start by saying that it's quite clear that eating is a voluntary behaviour. We make choices about what we pick up and we put into our mouths. But I think to imply that consumers have sole responsibility for the choices that they make actually completely undervalues the importance both of our biology and indeed of our environment. It's absolutely clear to most people here, I'm sure, that we have evolved in a world where food was scarce and where the energy required the energy we needed to expend to acquire that food was particularly large. And as a consequence, we're endowed with this ancient physiology which has been moulded by years of exposure to famine and to undernutrition. The consequence of that is that our biological regulatory systems are completely ill-equipped to handle the modern food environment. And of course, that is compounded by a situation in which we do so very little. I'm not going to talk about physical activity much more today, but I wouldn't want anybody to go away not thinking that this is also a key element in creating a fitter future. And there are many areas in which nutrition and physical activity are very closely entwined. But against this backdrop, it's perhaps not surprising that poor diet is a major contributor to ill health. So this is data taken from the World Health Organization report 2009, which looks at the leading risk factors in relation to their impact on DALYs, disability adjusted life years. And what you can see in these top 10 risk factors is that diet or risk factors which are strongly influenced by diet feature very, very prominently. Tobacco use, of course, remains the leading cause of morbidity and mortality. I'm not going to talk more about alcohol today, but you won't be surprised to hear that I've got a few words to say on obesity. High blood pressure, of course, very closely related to dietary salt intake. High blood glucose will be linked not only to obesity, but also perhaps to the nature and proportion of macronutrients in the diet, high cholesterol clearly linked to dietary fatty acids, and low fruit and vegetable intake. Collectively, poor diet is a huge contributor to morbidity. And estimates made by the previous government, the Cabinet Office report, Food Matters, suggested that improvements in dietary habits whereby people achieved some of the dietary recommendations would actually help us to avoid an estimated 70,000 premature deaths each year in the UK. And that was by achieving the goals for saturated fat, reductions in salt intake, increases in fruit and vegetables, and reductions in added sugar. What this chart doesn't show is the additional costs of obesity. And let's face it, obesity is the big problem that we face today. Almost two-thirds of adults in the UK are now overweight or obese. And if we look at young people, 2 to 15 years, it's almost one-third who are overweight. The direct costs to the NHS are conservatively estimated at about £5 billion a year. But much more critical is the indirect cost to the wider economy. Obesity impacts on so many aspects of our health, not just the metabolic effects, which is where a lot of the NHS costs lie, treating diabetes and so forth, but the wider impacts in terms of mechanical problems, low back pain, joint problems and so forth, as well as increasingly evidence of the associations with poor mental health. So it's absolutely evident that obesity costs not just individuals through the ill health and the morbidity, but it's costing businesses through time off work, lost productivity, and it's costing the wider society, not least through our contributions to the NHS. Now, we hear the statistics about obesity incredibly often, and one of the things which is beginning to concern me is that I can toss out the statement that two-thirds of adults are overweight and a third of young people, and everybody just sits there and it rather washes over us. So what I want to do is to just show you two pieces of data which perhaps will put a slightly different slant on it. One of the worries, I think, when we talk about the proportion of people who are overweight or obese is we're only thinking about the very top end, the very right-hand end of the distribution. So what's plotted here is the data for men and for women in traditional blue and red, and the data for 15 years apart. And what you can see in the dotted lines, which is back at the beginning of the 90s, and then the solid lines much more recently, is there has been a marked shift in the entire distribution. So what we're seeing is far more people now who are moving not just from being overweight into the obese category, but we're beginning to see people who were previously a healthy weight moving across too. And I think this reminds us that when we're thinking about obesity, it is not just a problem to treat those people who have very severe clinical obesity, morbid obesity even. This is genuinely a public health problem which affects the vast majority of the population, and hence this is absolutely in the territory of the food industry. The second thing that I want to say is the data from children, which make the point very, very clearly that obesity is an issue of inequalities, and differences in obesity underpin some of those long-term health inequalities. This, I think, is one of the most shocking pieces of data I've seen in some time, because what it shows you is the data from the National Child Measuring Programme, children measured in reception and in year six. And it shows the latest data expressed by decile of deprivation score. What we can see is that children living in the most deprived areas are twice as likely to be overweight or obese as those living in the most affluent areas. But what I think is most striking of all is that this is an almost continuous distribution. This is not an issue just of a small subgroup who are particularly vulnerable. This stretches across the whole population. And that, to me, tells us that this is an issue which we have to take seriously for society and not just for individuals. So with that backdrop, and of course I could spend a lot more time talking about the etiology of obesity and indeed of diet-related disease, I think it's fair to say that the problem we face is incredibly clear. The trouble is that the solution is not. And this is certainly true of obesity, but I think it probably also applies to many, many other aspects of diet-related disease. And in this situation, it's perhaps even more pertinent to ask, well, whose responsibility is it? Who should be doing something? Who is responsible for finding a solution? And if you ask diverse ranges of people, you can be pretty confident that at some point somebody will say, the government should do it. The government should sort it out. But the truth is that in peacetime, it's really quite difficult for the government to take a particularly invasive stance in terms of trying to change the nature of the food we eat. We know how strongly the media and indeed the public resist being told what to eat by ministers. And so, but the fact is that government can seek to influence the way the food system is shaped in much more subtle ways than just this kind of mandatory approach. Corinna Hawkes has done a lot of thinking and written some important articles exploring the changing relationships between government, industry, and consumers. In her paper in the BMJ earlier this year, she made the point that if we go back into the mid-1990s, governments really sought to intervene in agricultural production, particularly after the war, and in markets to boost output. And consumers were essentially seen as passive recipients of that growing food supply. The 1980s, there was a marked shift towards much more open markets, and farmers started competing in a global market to supply increasingly efficient systems of food manufacture and distribution. And by the 1990s, we'd reached a position where consumers were firmly in the driving seat. Consumers were seen to be the central point, and the assumption was that the demand from consumers would shape markets and drive a healthier food supply. The expectation we have is that consumers would choose well, and that in doing so, the food industry would step up and respond to those demands for tasty, delicious, affordable, and healthy food. The consequence of that is that economies would gain through this very market-orientated food sector, and we'd all have a much healthier population. That was the goal, that was the aspiration. What in fact has actually happened is that consumers are either not informed or not adequately informed, or were informed but still did not prioritise health when they're choosing food. And that left industry with incentives to mobilise the continuing demand for popular cheap items. And while some consumers undoubtedly have become healthier, taking full advantage of, you know, more opportunity than they'd ever had before to choose healthier products, the fact is that inequalities have increased, and at a population level, the cost of diet-related disease has soared. And that leaves us, I think, in this kind of scenario. Patently, the food system, the entire food system, is not working in support of a healthier nation. But the question is, whose responsibility is that? Is this kind of scenario, which at least I take small comfort in the fact still looks distinctly American, is this a failure of personal responsibility, or perhaps you might say parental responsibility? Or actually, is this child simply the passive victim of an irresponsible market? I think it's useful to think a little bit more about behaviour and the behaviour involved in making food choices, as we tend to describe them. The fact is, we all like to imagine we're rational, intelligent, educated individuals who make very, very sane and decisive choices. So when we're faced with a plate of delicious cakes or cheese or whatever happens to be your fancy, like me, I'm quite sure you stop and think, if I was to have that extra bit of cake, that would be another couple of hundred calories. That will put me into positive energy balance. That means I'll gain weight. That means I increase my risk of diabetes. That means I'll suffer huge morbidity and premature mortality. And you know, I think I better not eat the cake. The trouble is, I've eaten the cake before I've got even to the first step of that decision-making process. And the fact is, although we like to think we use all of that cognitive brain power, mostly our behaviour in relation to food is very impulsive. We make very immediate decisions in which the future is not represented. We make them very fast, and we do it often with minimal cognitive processing. We're busy people. We've got other things to do, and we prioritise bigger brain resources to make decisions other than what we put in our mouths. But the fundamental attribution error, which has been highlighted in this, is that we all still continue to believe that we're reflective individuals, and we underestimate the importance of those automatic impulsive behaviours. I think if you accept that, you begin to understand why years and years of health promotion and efforts to educate people, to inform them so that they will make better choices, have actually had much less impact than we would have liked them to achieve. That is not to say education isn't important. Of course it's not. But what I'm saying is it's important, but it is not sufficient to change behaviour. Now, in recent years, of course, we've tried to get a bit more sophisticated with our health promotion. It's not just about educating people. It's not campaigning now. It's social marketing. And I think we have at least started to try to think about the intrinsic motivations of individuals when they make food choices. But nonetheless, I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that social marketing is not sufficient to change behaviour. So in recent years, there's been growing interest in the idea of nudge. This arises out of the science of behavioural economics, or at least that combination of psychology and economics. It was really popularised in the book by Richard Thaler and Sunstein. It's sometimes also described as choice architecture, and it's an attempt to encourage individuals to make changes in their behaviour by appealing to this automaticity and the impulsivity. So if we make the healthy choices, the easier choices, because we're intellectually lazy, we'll perhaps slip into making the healthier choice. Now, in the Behaviour and Health Research Unit, which I am involved in Cambridge, we've been trying to unpick the idea of nudging in a bit more detail. But it perhaps won't surprise you that if you ask a group of academics to try to unpick nudge, you don't get something simpler, you actually get something a whole lot more complicated. So we first set out to define what we actually meant by nudge, and after a series of workshops and lots of iterative discussions, we've come up with the definition that nudging are interventions that involve altering the properties or the placement of objects or stimuli within microenvironments with the intention of eliciting health-enhancing behaviours. And that will probably become your best example of why you should never ask an academic for a simple answer. But the point in doing that is we were trying to conduct a scoping review of the literature to try to understand what the evidence is that nudging really can change behaviour. In order to do that, you need to really have a definition of what nudging actually is. So having come up with the definition, we set about doing what turned into sort of extreme reviewing. I don't know how many of you have done systematic reviews, but those of you who have will have some sympathy with the fact that we extracted over 800,000 records which were retrieved. We manually screened 54,000, and of those, 346 made it into the review. We were interested in four behaviours: diet, physical activity, alcohol, and tobacco. And what was fascinating to me, of all of those reported interventions, 70% of them were in relation to food. It's absolutely striking. And the vast majority of them, 40%, majority as in much bigger than all the other categories, were studies which involved point-of-choice labelling or prompting studies, which I think are actually debatable whether those even count as nudge or whether they're actually much more strictly in more of an educational intervention. Anyway, this paper's been submitted and hopefully will be accepted and then published before too long. But what we've gone on to do is to identify that there are a whole batch of interventions around the subject of sizing. And so we've chosen that to do an in-depth review to try to understand a little bit more how this whole idea of nudge works. So sizing, of course, is very, very relevant in relation to food. And this is a very quick and dirty synthesis that we put together a while ago, actually, to look at the evidence around portion size and energy intake. And it also makes the useful point that of the interventions we've identified, although they might be considered to be nudge interventions, some of them were nudges in a less rather than more healthy direction. And indeed, if you look at most of the literature on portion size, what it shows is that large portions increase the amount that people consume. There is little or no data on the impact of small portions on people's subsequent eating behaviour. And so what you can see here is that the laboratory studies are incredibly clear-cut, whether you look at single-meal studies on the left or whole-day studies on the right. For every extra 2.5 megajoules you provide to people, they consume about an extra 0.6, 0.7 megajoules. Absolutely clear, more larger portions increase energy intake. But what we don't yet know is whether we can turn that nudge into a health-promoting nudge, such that smaller portions nudge people to healthier behaviours. And of course, there's also the problem that laboratory studies like these don't necessarily pan out quite like that when you put them into the field. And, you know, we ask the food industry for smaller portions, and indeed, in one respect, that's what they delivered us. But actually, I think the question of whether these small portions actually are a help to people in controlling their intake or a positive hindrance in actually stimulating greater consumption is a question which we haven't satisfactorily addressed. And so what I'd conclude from this is that nudging is an interesting idea, but as yet we don't have good evidence of which nudges can be effective in actually eliciting health-promoting behaviours. Just take that a little step further. This is a diagram that originally came from Pekka Pushka, will be familiar to many people in the audience. It was also in the Health Select Committee report. And this makes the important distinction between individuals' responsibility and society. And what this tries to say is that clearly there are interventions we can do which will empower and strengthen the resolve of individuals to be able to push the boulder up the hill. But there is also a need for us to make the environment more conducive to that by effectively lowering the slope of that incline. But in the context of nudge, I think the question is whether nudges work equally on this boulder in both directions. It's perfectly possible to imagine that a small nudge will be very effective if it is going along the direction of travel, so to speak. So here, in the case of gravity, a small nudge will push a boulder down the hill very easily. Or in the case of food, a small nudge, if it's going with our biological drivers, it might be very easy to use nudging to get us to eat more calories, more fat, more sugar, and more salt. I think it's a completely unanswered question as to whether nudging will be sufficient to overcome those biological drivers and actually allow us to eat less. So moving on from nudge, what other options do we have? I think the concept set out here that we have to change society to make it easier for individuals to make the healthy choice really highlights the important role of the food industry, because when it comes to food, the industry is such an important part of shaping the environment and indeed shaping societal norms around food. And that really leads us to the heart of the responsibility deal. So the responsibility deal, for any of you who've been living on another planet for the last 2 years, is an initiative from the coalition government to work in partnership with a whole range of stakeholders to try to achieve a healthier environment, an environment which supports and enables people to make informed, balanced choices, not just about food, but there are also networks relating to physical activity, to alcohol, and to health at work. It's a voluntary partnership, and when I last made this slide, about 400 organisations have joined up. But there's certainly no doubt that it's growing really month by month as more and more people are making pledges and getting involved in taking voluntary action. As Colin said, I chair the Food Network, so I'm going to focus most of my attention on what we're doing in food. And we've really tried to adopt essentially a public health approach to changing dietary behaviours, which recognises that we need to take action in each of these four areas. I've talked a little bit already about empowering people to make better choices through education, but I think we're also interested in trying to make those healthier choices easier for them through things like improved labelling. There's clearly a batch of work to be done around the products themselves. Can we make those healthier, the sort of health by stealth agenda, reformulation, renovation, perhaps also some work on portion control. And then we're increasingly moving on to think about the places, the true food environment, the settings in which people consume food. And those settings, of course, can either encourage or indeed inhibit healthier eating behaviours. And finally, there's clearly a role for promotions, which at the moment perhaps are more usually seen in encouraging the less healthy rather than the healthier option. So I'm not going to talk in detail about the responsibility deal. That wouldn't be appropriate for this evening. But just to say we have, I'm delighted to say, six collective pledges, including the pledge on fruits and vegetables, which was launched today. I think it's been rather squeezed out of the media coverage by stories of alcohol in pregnancy. But nonetheless, some really important pledges, which I'll mention in a moment. I want to highlight really just two of these this evening, which I think have been perhaps particularly important and certainly illustrate, I think, key features about the responsibility deal. The first is the out-of-home calorie labelling pledge, which has seen us introduce calorie labelling on menus in out-of-home establishments, particularly those on the high street, over the last couple of years. By the end of last year, there were 5,000 high street food outlets displaying calories, and by the end of this year, we're confident that that should be around about 9,000. Consumers in the UK have become increasingly accustomed to having labelling on front of pack in the foods they eat in the supermarkets, and it's a logical extension that that should also apply to the food they consume out of home. If we want people to make better choices, they have to have the information to be able to do that. But I think what's been quite noticeable is that in introducing out-of-home labelling, it's also stimulated change, not only by consumers, but perhaps even more importantly by industry, because it becomes a prompt to looking at the nutritional content of those products. And we know from a number of companies that it's prompted significant renovation of their menus. The second one I want to highlight is the work on salt, and this really covers two of the pledges. The main salt pledge, which continues the work started by the Food Standards Agency on salt reduction, set new targets for the end of this year, which, if they were achieved in full, would have produced a further 15% reduction in the salt content of the UK diet. And more recently, we've introduced an additional pledge broken up into three parts for caterers, recognising that the incredibly diverse business models in that sector sometimes made it harder for them to achieve the specific salt targets in the first pledge. And so the additional pledges for caterers look at issues such as kitchen practices, reformulation of the products as sold to consumers, and procurement of their own ingredients. Salt reduction, without doubt, has been a huge UK success, and that is down to the voluntary action which has been taken by the UK food industry. And this is one of my very few graphs, but it's a graph absolutely worth showing, because what this demonstrates, based on data from very robust urinary sodium surveys as a measure of salt intake, it shows the marked and continuing decline in salt intake in the UK. And if ever you want any evidence that the industry is willing to play its part in improving public health, then this graph gives it you very, very clearly. As I mentioned a few moments ago, I think our newer pledges are beginning to move on beyond just looking at reformulation, portion control, and the product, and are now moving into far more issues relating to the place in which people buy food and settings. if you have chance to look at the details of the fruits and vegetables pledges today, you'll see a real diversity of effort on the part of the food industry to encourage and enable people to achieve their five a day. Five a day is a classic example. We've actually succeeded here with education. Pretty well everybody knows about five a day. The problem is only one in five people are actually doing it. And what we need is to find innovative new ways of supporting people to put what are often good intentions into practice. You know, there are the vast majority of people actually want to choose a healthier diet. They intend to eat more fruit and vegetables. But somehow when they get into the shops or when they get home late in the evening, it somehow is hard to translate that into practice. So some of the pledges we've seen today cover a real diversity of commitments. So you've got things which are quite education-based, but Waitrose, for example, are introducing a whole army of food produce advisors, fresh produce advisors in store to try to give people more advice on cooking and preparation of fresh produce. We've seen some of the manufacturers committing to reformulation of composite dishes, so Mars increasing the vegetable content in a number of their pasta sauce ranges. And we've seen, interestingly, a number of pledges around placement. So Aldi and Morrison's both committing to have greater floor space dedicated to fruits and vegetables and some new, more innovative approaches to presenting that fresh produce to consumers. And finally, we're also seeing in the fruit and veg pledges people beginning to think about using promotions, but building on some of the behavioural insights to try to come up with slightly more creative ways of promoting food. So, for example, there is, this is going to challenge me, which company is it? CH&Co, I think the caterers, who are introducing extra kind of bonus loyalty points on their loyalty card for people who choose additional servings of vegetables with their meals. And we're seeing Subway, who are doing some interesting promotional work using some of their celebrity ambassadors to promote extra portions of vegetables with their sandwiches. So a raft of initiatives which are beginning to move us on from just thinking about changing the product to thinking about how do consumers engage with the product and to actually get that synergy going between consumers and industry. So that takes me then to the very challenging area of food promotions. And this is a topic which we've said that we will pick up very specifically in the Food Network in the new year. It's a debate which has been going on for many years. Many of you will be familiar with it. And there have been a series of reports going back now to the early 2000s. Which suggested that food promotion, particularly to children, is predominantly unhealthy, or was when the reports were done, it probably still is, that marketing directly influences diet and dietary determinants. But the fact was that experimental research, which really showed the link between promotion and actual food choices, was extremely limited. But in recent years, I think the evidence base for that has strengthened quite considerably. So this is data just from one study. This is Jason Halford's work at the University of Liverpool, where they did a study with young children where they brought them into the laboratory and they watched programs which either interspersed with adverts for toys or adverts for food, and then afterwards were allowed to select and eat from a range of foods available. What you can see is the grey bars are after food and the clear bars are after the toy adverts. You can see that after seeing the food adverts, the children consistently consumed substantially more calories than after watching the toy adverts. And perhaps even more worryingly, there was an interaction with the weight status of the children, such that those who were obese seemed particularly sensitive to the impacts of the advertisements and increased their consumption of food by significantly more. I think this kind of research is hard to ignore, and I think tells us that if we're serious about creating an environment which promotes and supports healthier options, we have really got to look seriously at the balance of promotions in the wider food environment. So that leads me nicely in a way towards the end of what I wanted to say today, but really the question of how far should we go to intervene in people's food choices? I'm very often asked, you know, whether the responsibility deal is enough. Is it working? Is it doing enough? Is it strong enough? And of course, that's not a simple yes or no answer. It's much more nuanced than that. And the fact is that we're likely to need a whole portfolio of interventions which create a sort of surround sound to consumers if we want to begin to influence their eating behaviour. I think the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, when they did their public health report back now in 2007, actually had quite a neat way of thinking about this, which was in their model essentially of sort of libertarian paternalism. And what they suggested was that there was a ladder of interventions. And as one goes up the ladder, you are increasingly infringing on people's personal autonomy and freedom of choice. That may well be justified, but it can only be justified if you have evidence both that the interventions will be effective and that the goal that they have is worth the infringement of that personal liberty. So it doesn't tell you what's right or wrong, but I think it provides a framework for the discussion about how far is it reasonable for either the state or indeed the food industry to intervene in people's personal food choices. And it's perhaps worth reflecting on where we are now in the UK in relation to the portfolio of policies we have against this ladder. So I was trying to do this, and this is a bit of a matter of judgment, but quite clearly in the UK we are supreme at monitoring the situation. We have fantastic surveys, brilliant surveillance, and I absolutely don't want to knock that, but you know, we're definitely at first base. I think we have a well-established system of information and education, and Change for Life, I think, has taken that up to a whole new level. The food industry have done masses to enable choice. We are not short of choice when we go to make our purchases. But I think with the advent and improvements in labelling, we can now genuinely say that people do have the opportunities to make an informed choice. One further up, I think, is where reformulation sits. And this, of course, has been running for a long time, but is now being heavily picked up in the responsibility deal, where we're trying to guide choice by changing the default, making healthier choices the easy choices, or the health by stealth agenda, if you like. But once we get beyond that, it starts to get a little bit more patchy. But this, I think, the issue of guiding choice, both through incentives and disincentives, I think is where the nudge agenda starts to come in. And I think that's where we're seeing growing number of initiatives which are being developed. I couldn't really go through this talk without mentioning the topical issue of taxation. It's clearly a subject of increasing debate. I suspect that with the news from Denmark this week, that the issue of taxes on fat, saturated fat specifically, has probably taken a backward step. But certainly my sense is that the discussion, the debate, and the case for some sort of fiscal measures in relation to sugar-sweetened beverages is much stronger, and certainly a matter of significant discussion. The question is, how acceptable is that to people? Are people prepared to accept that degree of influence on their food choices? Once we go further up the ladder, it really is the number of policies are few and far between. And it's interesting that as far as I can tell, we have only got to those top two rungs in the matter of influencing the diets of children, where I think the state has a much, much clearer duty of care. And so I think what we see in terms of restricting choice, one might argue that the Ofcom restrictions in relation to advertising of foods high in fat, sugar and salt is to some extent restricting choice, but perhaps a better example is some of the planning controls that some local authorities have now introduced in relation to zoning, particularly trying to restrict fast food outlets close to schools. And of course, in the case of some of the school food standards, we have gone so far as to actually ban certain items, effectively eliminating choice entirely. So this is a question not just for scientists, not just for policymakers. It's a question for all of us, really, to consider how serious is the crisis we face in diet-related disease, and therefore how much intrusion into people's personal choices is it reasonable for government or indeed industry to make. I think it'd be clear from everything I've said this evening that I am absolutely convinced that the only way we can make progress is if we do this in a coordinated manner. What we need to see is consumers who are demanding healthier choices, a competitive industry rising to that challenge to meet the needs of their consumers, innovation which will stimulate further consumer demand, and so we generate that virtuous circle in which everybody can win and everybody can benefit. I have to say, I am more optimistic than I've probably been ever before that we're beginning to make some progress in that. I think there is much greater awareness from businesses that the old model, which was kind of predicated just on selling more calories, is not good enough and is not going to be a sustainable option for the future. I think I also hear increasing calls from consumers for a food industry which respects their food values and which genuinely is trying to help them achieve their aspirations. And I hope that that means together we really can begin to make some progress. The challenge is that trying to set up these policies in support of a healthy diet is tricky. But it's not as tricky as it gets. It's much more complex than that, because health is only one aspect of the wider food policy. And when we start to try to integrate the policies which might shape our food supply for health, we also have to remember there's a vast array of other factors which need to be thought about too. We hear a lot in nutrition about that transition from undernutrition into a world of plenty, the so-called nutrition transition. And what I think we've now got to face up to is that we're at a point in time where we've got to make the next transition into a truly sustainable food system. And that's not going to be easy, and it's going to require something which is truly transformational, I think, in the way in which business goes about its job. And it's certainly a challenge that neither consumers nor business can do on its own. But I remain confident that if we work together in partnership, that we can indeed look forward to a fitter future. Thank you.